All right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the American Jewish Experience, Part 4, Culture. And we're sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yona Ben Reb Aryeh Leib, and I thank the Katzes for their sponsorship. By culture, which is a very broad topic, I mean the influence of Jews primarily on sports, music, literature, and media, which is usually arbiter and publicist of culture, as well as other societal norms and values. So I lay my cards on the table right at the beginning. I know a lot about sports, a little about music, and almost nothing about literature. I almost never read fiction. I used to read the New York Times for that, and even that I stopped many years ago. I read the Wall Street Journal now, which is a fine paper. And those Jewish novelists who have been most influential in American culture usually had nothing good to say about Judaism, so for me it was a waste of time. But we should begin, as we have in the past, with an overview of how the Torah perceives culture. Is there such a thing as a Jewish culture, a Torah culture? So we speak of Tarbut Yavan, Greek culture, especially around the Hanukkah time, but is there such a thing as Tarbut Yehudi that encompasses art and music and literature and sports? So certainly for those who live in the Dalet Amot Shel Halacha, in the world of Talmud Torah, there's really no need for it, nor much of an understanding of it. Stories told, it's a true story. It was either about Rav Elyashiv or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was approached by some teenagers who asked if they're allowed to play soccer on Shabbat. And the Rav didn't know what it was, so he asked, what's the purpose of the game? And the boys explained the purpose of the game is to put the ball into the goal. And the Rav answered, with all due seriousness, why don't they just put the ball in the goal before Shabbat? And this way you won't have to play on Shabbat. So the question is there such a thing as Jewish culture? The question is loaded because rabbis in the 19th century railed against the maskilim for creating such a culture, which was largely antagonistic to rabbis and Torah and often God. But is that necessarily so? Culture operates in two spheres: as the articulation of a society's values in a particular realm, sometimes pushing out the envelope of these values and challenging existing norms, but also serves as a distraction from the main focal points of life. Culture is not a career, but it's essentially a diversion from one's primary pursuits in life, which for us, in no particular order, Torah, mitzvot, avodat Hashem, family, job, etc. Every society will have diversions, but the need to partake of them will vary for every individual. So the Rambam says in the fifth parak of the Shemona Prakim, working from the premise of the pasuk in Mishlei, "Bechol drachecha do'ehu," know God in all your ways. Or as the Mishnah says in Avot, "V'chol masecha yiyu l'shem shamayim," that all your deeds, should be for the sake of heaven. So Rambam notes that people's primary obligation in life is to dedicate all their energies and resources to God. That doesn't only mean learning Torah and davening. It means that when we eat and drink and sleep, we should have in mind not personal pleasure, but that we're doing all these things to give us strength to serve Hashem. Thus the Rambam states, "Vakavana bivriyut gufo shen timtza nefesh klaya briyim ushleimim lechos b'chachmot." The whole purpose of keeping a healthy body is that we should maintain, in this context he writes, healthy kidneys, so we'll be able to hold on to grasp wisdom and to acquire good virtues until we come to the end, which is to be an Eved Hashem. That's what it means, V'chol ma'asecha yu l'shem shemayim, that all your deeds, even your optional activities. And even the Rambam acknowledges that we generally cannot learn more than 9 hours a day. That's his figure from the laws of Talmud Torah. He works it out how it's possible. But he says it doesn't pay to learn more than 9 hours a day because the mind ceases absorbing and requires some rest. All right, so we have a long way to go to reach 2 hours a day, much less 9. But just like the body has to rest, the Rambam writes, Kein titzarecha nefesh gam kein lihiraga. So too the psyche has to rest as well, v'la'asok b'nuchat chushim, and to engage in rest for the senses. How does one do that? So the Rambam writes in the Shemona Prakim, Kemo ha-histaklut b'tziurim uvidvarim ha-naim ad she-tasur mimena halayud. By looking at beautiful pictures and other beautiful things until the fatigue is gone. What is that rest? So the rest is looking at pleasant pictures. Chazal understood the need for this relaxation, so we always had art and music regulated by halacha. Sports was associated with the vulgar excesses of Hellenist culture, but didn't have to be, and it existed also in the time of the Gemara. I have a few references in Talmudic literature to a kadur. I just think of the pasuk in Kohelet, Devrei Chachamim Kador Banot, the words of the sages are like goads, prods, but Chazal darshened in the Medrash, kador banot, like a girl's ball, meaning the Mesor, the words of the Chachamim, are passed down like a ball. You could hand a ball, throw a ball to someone, and nothing is diminished or lost from the ball. But the fact they had this idea of a kador banot meant that such a thing did exist. It's natural that Rav Kook was the most open-minded to these modern notions, sports, literature, art. He once explained, it's in his commentary to Brachot Daf Hei, that not everything that is not pure Talmud Torah is considered Bittul Torah, because everyone has reshut, permission to work and earn money, even more than they need. The thing is, he emphasized, there's no universal standard for measuring Bittul Torah. It depends on each individual. And thus he prays, this is in Orot, in Simon Pei, Daf Pei rather, the young people of his generation and their hitamlut, their exercise, their calisthenics, that strengthens their bodies, b'shviliot banim amitze koach l'uma, so they should be stout young men in the service of the nation. And such a holy endeavor, keeping the body in shape, called avodat hakodesh, it raises up the divine presence, malo, malo, and all that is part of b'chol drachecha do'ehu. Of course, he wrote that, and he later had to repudiate the insinuation of his enemies that who distorted his words as if he's permitting them to play soccer on Shabbat, which of course was never his intention. So too, Rav Kook spoke of the need of reviving Jewish culture in the modern state. The next passage in Orot, referring to the need for Sifrut Yisraelit, for a Hebrew and Israeli literature that can only succeed with the sanctification of the souls of the sofrim, of the writers and authors. And Rav Kook perceived literature as a window into the experiences of others, a way to understand humanity and broaden our horizons, because we cannot experience every culture, every nation. It's physically impossible. But if it's not done by Kedusha, it could be destructive. And he wrote the same thing of art. He wrote favorably of the founding of the Bezalel School of Art, as long as they don't make sculptures or use nudes. And of course, they thanked him for his support, and then they ignored him, making sculptures as well. But Rav Kook lived on an ideal plane, and he did not see why all these things could not enrich a Jew's life, or why its practitioners would not operate from a holy framework. So it's safe to say that in all these areas, Rav Kook's aspirations were not immediately realized, although we are edging ever closer to it, and you see that in Israel. There's a whole literature, there's religious novels that are being written and religious films that are made, that, and you know, religious TV, people look at, you know, Shtisel, Surgim, etc., and all of it is the transmission of messages or insights into a particular community that all in all speak well of the Torah, the actors, etc., which itself is a sea change from the way culture has generally perceived or interpreted the Torah. Certainly, not everyone agreed, and it's quite safe to say they disagreed, especially when we posit that Torah is the ultimate value. So the story is told that when the great Reb Shimon Shkop, one of Reb Chaim's top Talmidim, Rosh Yeshiva in Grodno, when he visited Torah Vadas in the late 1920s, he happened to walk in to the yeshiva during recess, and he was astonished to see boys playing baseball. And he said, how could it be that boys who learned Torah would participate in such frivolities? It didn't compute in his mind. But conversely, the Maitre d'Eloi, another one of the great Talmidim of Reb Chaim, Reb Shlomo Palachek, who later became the Rosh Yeshiva, really the first well-known Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, although he died in the late 1920s, he saw boys playing in the public school in Brisk, and he lamented, and it's the introduction to a sefer, Chidush HaYilim Mimeitzit, what harm would it have caused had they allowed us during the day, growing up, ma'at kfitza, o ma'at ritza, jumping around, running around, what harm would that have caused? None. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky felt the same way, and in fact he attributed his long life and good health to the fact that even when he was in Slobodka, for his teenage years, he was an avid swimmer, and he would swim long distance in the Nevis River, which was just a few blocks from the yeshiva. And similarly, the Chafetz Chaim wrote of the importance of allowing students to exercise and to swim and to keep their bodies healthy. Even Rabbi Menashe Klein writes in the Mishnah Halachot, Chelek Yud Bet, Siman Tov Ayin Bet, L'chein im ha'schok shebachurim olchim l'schok mevi lidei shleimut adam. If playing the games that boys play brings them to some level of perfection, harehu mitzvah u'mutar l'schok hadur. It's a mitzvah and it's permissible to play with a ball. V'imlav, if it doesn't bring shleimut, then it's asur, it's for the mamlechat kohanim v'goy kadosh. So why would princes, why would a holy people be involved in such things? It all depends on intention. So it can't be an end in itself. But in America, sports served another function as well, and that's a means of acculturation into American life in a healthy, permissible way. I know many rabbonim who were fine athletes back in the day, and especially baseball always had an attraction to not only yeshiva students, but to Rosh Yeshiva as well. I remember years ago, I used to give a seminar for young rabbis, and one question that would come up repeatedly, should a rabbi play a ball with his members? So I answered, only if he can hit. Because to play with the members and play poorly, that's already Chil Hashem. So is there a particularly Jewish influence on American culture? Let's see. We begin with sports, and that's not just a question of listing famous Jews in sports, because that's not necessarily a Jewish influence. You could find a few of any ethnic group. I want to focus on how in each of these areas of culture, Jews shaped it in substantive and sometimes dramatic ways. There's no doubt that this will offend some people, maybe many people, but it's frivolous to say that Jewish athletes influenced American sports, which is not to say we haven't had some fine athletes. But, you know, in a famous scene from the classic movie Airplane, a stewardess is distributing reading material, and a sweet old lady asks her, do you have anything light? And the stewardess thumbs through all the magazines and hands her a piece of paper the size of an index card, which says on it, famous Jewish sports legends. And the old lady cheerfully says, oh, thank you very much. Said another way, Johnny Halpert, who coached YU's basketball team for a half century, once said in an interview that his players do not become professional athletes. I quote, "They're the ones who stitch their knees and negotiate their contracts." That is true. All right, they're trying to change it now. But we all maintain, including myself, the fantasy that but for the Shabbat issue, we would all be playing professional sports. Never a question of talent. It was only Shabbat held us back. But of course, Jews have had some success in sports as athletes. In fact, the very first home run king in baseball, a superstar, was Lipman Pike. Lipman Pike from Brooklyn. All right, let's not get too excited. He holds the National Association all-time record of 15. But he played in the early years of baseball, the 1860s, 1870s, first as an amateur, then as a professional. He bounced from the Philadelphia Athletics, despite his prowess, because they considered him a foreigner. Foreigner meaning a Jew. But here's his significance. As amateurs, at the beginning, they could earn no money. But Pike and some teammates were paid under the table. This led to his being summoned to a hearing by the governing board of baseball, because he was a superstar. Nothing came of it, except it led to the founding in 1869 of the Cincinnati Red Stockings, the first professional team, of course today the Cincinnati Reds. So in fact it was because of Lipman Pike that professional baseball really became what it was. So Jews began playing baseball and following baseball because it was a short and direct route to feeling American. And Jews rejoiced in the successes of Hank Greenberg and Al Rosen. Some famous players were hidden Jews through Jewish mothers. Ralph Branca claimed he never knew he was Jewish until he was much older. But in fact, his mother was Jewish, came from a religious family. Lou Boudreau always knew he was a Jew through his mother as well. Or Mo Berg, the catcher who became a spy and provided the United States with his pictures of Japanese installations. He filmed them during barnstorming tours in the 1930s that helped the U.S. target Japanese facilities during World War II. And Berg actually served in Europe for the OSS during the war. He spoke, a fascinating figure, he spoke 9 languages, and as his manager, one of his managers, Casey Stengel, once lamented, he speaks 9 languages and can't hit in any of them. But no Jew captured the imagination of Jews more than did Sandy Koufax, the greatest 5-year run as a pitcher in baseball history before retiring at the young age of 30 because of an arthritic left arm. That arm was widely revered. It was called the left arm of God for the anthropomorphists. And what he accomplished was staggering. But he achieved his greatest fame among Jews, and I think to a large extent among non-Jews also, and had the greatest influence by not pitching on Yom Kippur during the 1965 World Series, missing the first game of the series. Now, Hank Greenberg had also not played on Rosh Hashanah back in the day, but that was acknowledged, was not as celebrated because it wasn't the World Series. In fact, neither Greenberg nor Koufax went to shul that day, but it seems possible that Koufax did fast. Yet in one famous tale, conservative Rabbi Bernard Raskis of Temple Aaron in St. Paul, from the pulpit that Yom Kippur day, welcomed Koufax to the temple, and he urged members not to disturb him. That wasn't too difficult because Koufax wasn't there. And he later just said that he spent the day in his hotel room. Raskis' assistant rabbi said decades later that it wouldn't have been a surprise if Raskis had performed such a stunt. He was a bit of an entertainer. But what might be true is this, because he's still alive, the next day, Rav Moshe Feller, who is the first Chabad Shaliach in Minnesota, and today he's an older man, he's still alive, he's the head Shaliach in all the Midwest. So he tells a story that the day after Yom Kippur, he visited the hotel, he asked for Koufax's room number, and was given it by the receptionist, who assumed this was Sandy Koufax's rabbi. So he called the room, Koufax invited him up, And when he walked in, Rav Moshe Feller, you know, Feller is also a famous baseball name, but Rav Feller congratulated him for not pitching on Yom Kippur. So Koufax answered, I didn't pitch on Rosh Hashanah either. And I looked it up, and it's true, he didn't pitch on the 2 days Rosh Hashanah, just 10 days before. Rav Feller said to him as follows, and this is his account. You should know, thousands of Jewish businessmen did not go to work on Yom Kippur because you wouldn't pitch. Do you know how many Jewish kids didn't go to school on Yom Kippur because you wouldn't pitch on Yom Kippur? When you announced weeks before the game that you would not pitch on Yom Kippur, you informed thousands of Jews when Yom Kippur would take place because more Jews read the newspaper than have Jewish calendars in their homes. So in great appreciation of the great Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of God's name that you made by not pitching on Yom Kippur, I want to present you with a pair of tefillin. He said he didn't know what to get since Koufax throws left-handed but bats right-handed, but he gave him a lefty pair of tefillin. And Rav Feller asked Sandy if he needs help putting it on. Koufax answered, no, I know how to put them on. In fact, he did not put them on right then, Rabbi Feller said. But he thanked the rabbi profusely. And Koufax became a symbol of Jewish pride, used as a role model by generations of rabbis trying to teach Jewish teens not to be ashamed of their heritage. Rabbi Wein once said that when Sandy Koufax stated he would not pitch on Yom Kippur, many Jews in America stood a little taller and had a better sense of self-worth and Jewish pride. And that was as true in the Orthodox observant community as it was in the general Jewish community. And I don't doubt that that message wasn't lost on American society altogether. I mentioned a few weeks ago, I went to this museum in Tel Aviv, the UNU Museum, the updated version of the Diaspora Museum, and I was outraged. They had a cartoon, almost a program cover of Sandy Koufax with his number 32 and his glove in his left hand and his right hand moving as if he was right-handed. And I called over a docent and I said, Ma Korepo, this is supposed to be a professional museum. Everybody knows Koufax was left-handed. And he said to me, Behmet? So I dialed up on YouTube a clip of Koufax pitching, and he said, I'm going right down to the office now. We want to be accurate. The aftermath is not as well known. Don Drysdale pitched that day in Koufax's spot and was bombed, giving up 7 runs in less than 3 innings. When the manager, Walter Alston, came to remove Drysdale from the game, Drysdale quipped, I bet right now you wish I was Jewish too. But then there's this, which is not well known either. Koufax pitched well the next day in the second game, but lost, giving up 1 earned run in 6 innings. He learned his lesson. He pitched 2 more games in the series, both complete game shutouts, including Game 7 on 2 days rest, and he won the Most Valuable Player Award in the series. Those are players, and that's Koufax's lasting influence. I think probably in our world, that's what he's most famous for. But the impact on American society, especially in the middle of the 60s, just led every ethnic group start to express their individuality. For all the Jews who played and still play baseball, perhaps the greatest impact on the sport and American sports was through the work of Marvin Miller, the lawyer who became the head of the Baseball Players Association, led them on strike in the early 1970s and eventually completely upended pro sports by enabling players to seek free agency. So in baseball, from time immemorial, players were bound to their teams by the reserve clause, meaning they could play for the team that owned them, for what the team wanted to pay them, or they could go home empty-handed. Through the legal system and an arbitration decision, players won the right to choose their teams every time their contracts expire. That's free agency. There's some limitations on it, but it's led to an exponential escalation in salaries. This Marvin Miller revolution led Red Barber, the famous broadcaster, to say that Marvin Miller who himself was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, was one of the three most important people in baseball history after Babe Ruth and Jackie Robinson. So it's not only as players or lawyers. Jewish voices have become synonymous with sports, making these Jews household names in American homes, and in many cases reshaping the way sports is understood. Take really the first famous Jewish broadcaster, Marty Glickman. Marty Glickman was a legendary track star who went to the Munich Olympics in 1936, but was not allowed to run to compete due to the overt Jew hatred of the infamous Avery Brundage, who didn't want to offend Hitler by having a Jew stand on the podium after winning. It's the same Brundage, by the way, who after 11 Israeli athletes were murdered by Arab terrorists at the next Munich Olympics in 1972, demanded infamously that the games must go on. But Glickman became a pioneer broadcaster for football and especially basketball. And it's Glickman who coined the terms that define the sport until today. Swish, key, lane, top of the circle, etc. These are all Marty Glickman phrases. And he was the mentor for Marvin Aufricht, who we know better as Marv Albert, who championed yes instead of swish, and was one of the most famous broadcasters in many sports in America, who just retired a few months ago. Add to this list Mel Allen, the voice of the Yankees, originally Melvin Allen Israel. He dropped the Israel. Howard Cosell was Howard Cohn, he of the distinctive and quite irritating voice. Al Michaels, who's still around. Dick Stockton, the New York Rangers' Sam Rosen, was born in a German DP camp in 1947. His parents were Holocaust survivors, and many, many others. It'd be hard to escape the conclusion that in many ways it's the Jewish voice that has shaped American sports and made it memorable. Take another facet of this. There was a time not long ago, really just two decades ago, when three of the four commissioners of the major sports were Jews. Baseball had Bud Selig, who was also an owner. Basketball had David Stern, today Adam Silver. And hockey had and still has Gary Bettman. This is not normal. Add to that, the NBA's basketball founder was Maurice Podoloff, who was born under the Tsar's reign. He was the first commissioner. He became a lawyer, and he negotiated the merger of the two extant leagues, the NBL and the BAA, and that became the NBA. As president, he hired Marty Glickman to be the first broadcaster in the NBA, not to his credit. Podoloff replaced Glickman after a year with Lindsey Nelson, who later became a Mets broadcaster. Lindsey is from the Midwest, because Glickman, he said, sounded too ethnic, meaning too Jewish. So in these capacities, Stern, Bettman, Selig, they've guided American sports into the money-making machine that it is today. It shouldn't be a big surprise, but Jews are overrepresented among the owners of professional sports teams. Steve Cohen just bought the Mets, but the Gilberts, the Glazers, Mark Lasry owns the reigning NBA champion Bucks, Robert Kraft, Jeff Lurie, Bruce Ratner, Jerry Reinsdorf, Carol Rosenblum, Daniel Snyder, Stuart Sternberg, Ziggy Wolf, all Jews, even Mark Cuban is Jewish. His grandfather came to Ellis Island with the name Chabensky. He shortened it to Cuban. And dozens of others, far in excess to our percentage of the population. And some of these people own teams in multiple sports. All right, how about some football? I'd be exaggerating to suggest that Jews have an outsized influence in football. There have always been relatively few Jews playing football. We care for our heads a little much, understandably so. One very impactful player was Sid Luckman, Brooklyn-born, Columbia graduate. He was the first great quarterback, and he revolutionized the game from primarily running the ball to passing it downfield. And Luckman won 5 championships in 12 years with the Chicago Bears, and the game was never the same. And yet, Three Jews shape the modern NFL in ways that people really do not recognize. The NFL was the league. Pro football added a league in 1960 against the opposition, with the opposition of the NFL, called the AFL, the American Football League, largely due to the efforts of Lamar Hunt, who couldn't get an NFL franchise, and so eventually owned the Chiefs and the AFL, but three Jews also. Sid Gillman, Sonny Werblin, and Al Davis. What Luckman did as a player, Sid Gillman did as a coach, and in the AFL, he pioneered a pass-happy offense, including utilizing the running backs or as pass receivers on the sides of the fields. Oddly, something that had never been done before. And Gilman and his chief scout, Al Davis, also Jewish, later the brash coach and owner of the Oakland Raiders, recruited players from historically black colleges, something that the NFL then was hesitant to do. This was the early 1960s. When Gilman's San Diego Chargers won the championship in 1963, he told the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, that he wanted to play the NFL champion Bears. And he telegraphed Rozelle, Pete, even Pope John recognized the other league, meaning the Jews. It was the year of Vatican II. Rozelle responded, Sid, yes, but it took him 2,000 years. 3 years later, Rozelle relented, and thus was born the Super Bowl, really because of Gilman and Rozelle. Before that could happen, Sonny Werblin, born in Brooklyn as David Abraham Werblin, bought the New York Titans after the Titans owner, Harry Wismer, called him a kike. And Werblin said, someday I'm going to own your team. And he bought it a few months later. Werblin changed the name of the team to the Jets. They played near LaGuardia, but in Shea Stadium, so Jets just rhymed with Mets. And the team uniform to this day is green because Werblin was born on March 17th. By profession, he was a talent agent, representing, among others, Johnny Carson and Jackie Gleason. But with Carson's influence, it was Werblin who negotiated a lucrative television package with NBC, and of course, sports teams make their money from television rights until this day. Once they made their money from television, they were set. And then when Werblin signed the flamboyant Joe Namath for his renamed Jets for a then staggering sum of $427,000, Werblin put the NFL on the map. So he won the third Super Bowl. Jets fans know they haven't won since. 1969, while the second was lost by Al Davis, who was the owner of the Raiders, famous for his slogan, Just Win, Baby. Werblin, after he left the Jets, went on to build the Meadowlands, which still stands, and then he headed Madison Square Garden. Davis, meanwhile, aggressive, paranoid, always angry, became the AFL commissioner while still heading the Raiders, and eventually Rozelle caved under the pressure and the two leagues merged. It was Werblin's decision to retain the New York in the Jets' names, even though they moved to New Jersey, and Werblin explained, I guess quite cogently, if you paved the Hudson River, it would be called 13th Avenue. So, of course, New Jersey is just part of New York. It was a marketing decision because New York has more glamour than New Jersey. That's football. There have been a few Jewish football players, but generally, except for the early years of basketball, when Jews were better represented, Jews have featured more as owners and as coaches in basketball. Basketball really started, in a sense, as a New York game. So you had the Reds, Red Auerbach, Red Holtzman, Nat Holman, all of whom shaped the game in one way or another. The first basket ever recorded in professional basketball, November 1st, 1946, was scored for the Knicks by Queens native Ozzie Schechtman. And who led the league in scoring that first year? It was Max Zaslavsky. Of course, you have to look with a microscope to find Jews playing today. What about hockey? The current commissioner aside, it's hard to discern a major Jewish influence on hockey. I'll just note, Zechula Tov, Adam Fox of the Rangers, won the Norris Trophy last year. All right, so we move now to music. And what leaps to mind are those Jews who contributed something that was unique. Obviously, there are many Jews in music, musicians. Our love of music goes back to the Beit HaMikdash, the Leviim. Everyone knows, everyone in America really knows of Israel Belin, who was born in a Russian shtetl and who became Irving Berlin, who fled his Jewish heritage with alacrity, intermarried twice, and was quite the Jewish influence, as we all know. I'm dreaming of a white... Yes, that's a Jewish song, Irving Berlin. Benny Goodman, the clarinetist and band leader, who really introduced jazz into American culture, and also intermarried. Woody Guthrie was Jewish, as was his son Arlo Guthrie, who, strangely enough, got his bar mitzvah lessons from Rabbi Meir Kahana. Hashem Kom Damo. Steve Lawrence, he's originally a Leibowitz. His father was a chazan in the Bronx. His wife, Edie Gourmet, her parents were Sephardic Jews from Turkey. Paul McCartney, now he's not Jewish, but his wife Linda was. Neil Sedaka, just listen to the name. Sedaka, another Sephardi. David Lee Roth, Gene Simmons, Kiss, a bit of a nut, born in Israel as Chaim Weitz. Gene Simmons' mother was a Holocaust survivor. He's one weird dude, but he's a big supporter of Israel. There are hundreds of others. But I'm thinking more of those who also introduced or popularized a new genre. And those really the folk singers like Bob Dylan or Simon and Garfunkel. Dylan grew up as Robert Zimmerman, Shabtai Zissel Zimmerman, in Hibbing, Minnesota. His mother apparently at one time was a member of the temple that claimed Sandy Koufax davened there. He was trained for his bar mitzvah. His fans know his Parshat Naso. He recalled by an Orthodox rabbi from Brooklyn with a long beard who was soon after fired by the congregation for being too religious. So Dylan left for New York to pursue a career as a singer. He was another revolutionary. Not much of a voice, but lyrics that made you think and really channeled the angst and aspirations of the youth of the 1960s. Dylan is a seeker of truth, Ad Hayom, who's bounced from Judaism to Christianity and back, that's likely to be wearing tefillin one day as a cross the next. And then he's a longtime supporter of Chabad. He became close to the legendary Shlomo Freifeld of Shar Yoshev Yeshiva in Far Rockaway, and dropping out of society for years at a time. He's a very thoughtful individual. Many years ago, I read the first volume of his autobiography, and he wrote that he never saw himself as a political revolutionary, and he dropped out the first time. He retreated from society when the youth started to perceive him as the leader of a movement. And he said, "What movement? I just want to write and sing music." But think of the impact in the 60s and thereafter. Blowing in the Wind, The Times They Are Changing, Like a Rolling Stone, voted the best song in history by, well, Rolling Stone magazine, which also named Dylan the top songwriter in history. So he dropped out of college in 1960, came to New York, and he started singing in clubs in Greenwich Village. A year later, he signed with the legendary manager Albert Grossman, who also managed Janis Joplin, and the activist singers Peter, Paul, and Mary. Peter Yarrow was Jewish, and it was Grossman who put the three together. You all have bad voices, so maybe if you put the three together, it'll sound like something people can listen to. Dylan has gone through many musical incarnations, but he still performs at age 80. Here's a good marketing trick. 35 years ago, he began what he called the never-ending tour. It's perfect. You never have to change the name even. You can sing as long as you want. 5 years ago, he became the only songwriter ever to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. Naturally, he did not go to the, he didn't show up in Stockholm for the ceremony, accepted the award graciously. He said he had a prior commitment, but he remains an extraordinarily private individual. And for a very complex person, his Jewish identity is strong. One of his children is Orthodox. But listen to the lyrics of a song he wrote in 1983 that I heard about years ago. But then I was doing research for this, it just struck me with its veracity and its power. It's called The Neighborhood Bully, and it's about Israel. It's 1983. It's as applicable today as in the past. I hope you look it up later, The Neighborhood Bully, but listen to the lyrics and try to imagine it in his voice. Well, the neighborhood bully, he's just one man. His enemies say he's on their land. They got him outnumbered about 1,000,000 to 1. He got no place to escape to, no place to run. He's the neighborhood bully. The neighborhood bully just lives to survive. He's criticized and condemned for being alive. He's not supposed to fight back. He's supposed to have thick skin. He's supposed to lay down and die when his door is kicked in. He's the neighborhood bully. The neighborhood bully been driven out of every land. He's wandered the earth an exiled man, seen his family scattered, his people hounded and torn. He's always on trial for just being born. He's the neighborhood bully. Well, he knocked out a lynch mob. He was criticized. Old women condemned him, said he should apologize. Then he destroyed a bomb factory. Nobody was glad. The bombs were meant for him. He's supposed to feel bad. He's the neighborhood bully. Well, the chances are against it, and the odds are slim that he'll live by the rules that the world makes for him, because there's a noose at his neck and a gun at his back, and a license to kill him is given out to every maniac. He's the neighborhood bully. He got no allies to really speak of. When he gets, he must pay for, he don't get it out of love. He buys obsolete weapons and he won't be denied, but no one sends flesh and blood to fight by his side. He's the neighborhood bully. Well, he's surrounded by pacifists who all want peace. They pray for it nightly that the bloodshed must cease. Now they wouldn't hurt a fly. To hurt one, they would weep. They lay and they wait for this bully to fall asleep. He's the neighborhood bully. Every empire that's enslaved him is gone. Egypt and Rome, even the great Babylon. He's made a garden of paradise in the desert sand, in bed with nobody under no one's command. He's the neighborhood bully. Now his holiest books have been trampled upon. No contract he signed was worth what it was written on. He took the crumbs of the world and turned it into wealth. Took sickness and disease and he turned it into health. He's the neighborhood bully. What's anybody indebted to him for? Nothing, they say. He just likes to cause war. Pride and prejudice and superstition indeed. They wait for this bully like a dog waits to feed. He's the neighborhood bully. What has he done to wear so many scars? Does he change the course of rivers? Does he pollute the moon and stars? Neighborhood bully standing on the hill, running out the clock, then standing still. Neighborhood bully. I wish every Jewish teenager and college student knew this song, which is the most concise yet poetic description of Israel's plight that I've ever heard. In fact, I wish all American Jews heard it as well, The Neighborhood Bully. So two other influential icons were Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, childhood friends from Queens, always had a cantankerous relationship. So it's hard to say their songs were molded by their Jewishness. Books have been written about Dylan's Jewish influence, but theirs, like Dylan's, was the voice of a generation. And that generation's voice and other loftier aspects of the 1960s was heard raucously loud and clear at Woodstock in August 1969. And who would know? Note this anomaly. Three of the four organizers of Woodstock were Jews. In fact, one just died two days ago, Michael Lang. Three of the four organizers were Jews. The venue was also that of a Jew, Max Yazger's Dairy Farm in Bethel, New York. Oddly, Yazger was a conservative Republican, a Nixon supporter, his son said, and pro the Vietnam War. But he was troubled on free speech grounds that the organizers were being denied venue after venue. And for almost 4 days, up in upstate New York, Rock bands played, people got drunk and drugged and abandoned all inhibitions. In American culture, it's considered a watershed moment. Dylan, who lived in Woodstock, didn't appear, he was in England, nor did Simon and Garfunkel, who were recording an album, but many legendary bands of the 1960s did. After that, I was a child, but I was in Israel at the time, so I was unaffected by all of it. Some other great musicians, some of the greatest composers in American history were Jews, such as Aaron Copland, George Gershwin, Leonard Bernstein, who became famous as a composer and a conductor. A composer, think of On Our Town and Peter Pan, West Side Story. Of the four creators of West Side Story, music, lyrics, screenwriter, director, choreographer, all four were Jews. Another American classic duo was Rodgers and Hammerstein, but there was Richard Rodgers, who was the Jew, not Oscar Hammerstein II, whose mother was a Gentile. But Rodgers was born in Queens. He composed the music for 43 Broadway musicals, Oklahoma, South Pacific, The King and I, Sound of Music, and more. Rodgers is only one of two people in history to win an Oscar, an Emmy, a Tony, a Grammy, and a Pulitzer Prize. Only one of two people. And the other was Marvin Hamlisch, famous for The Sting and A Chorus Line, The Way We Were. Only two people won those five top entertainment awards, and both of them were Jews. Without the influence of Jews, American music is not the same. And there are dozens and dozens of others that I'm omitting. Consider, Take Me Out to the Ball Game was written by a Jew, Harry von Tilzer. Talk about hiding your Jewish identity. He was originally born Aaron Gumbinski. His mother was a Tilzer, and he just adopted Harry, similar to Aaron, but he added the von, so he shouldn't appear as a Jew. God Bless America, again Irving Berlin. The impact is incredible, and more dubious, but really illustrating the point, Jews have written some of the classic Christian songs. The intermarried Irving Berlin wrote staples for all the Christian holidays. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was written by a Jew based on a story written by his brother-in-law, another Jew. Chestnuts Roasting on Open Fire was written by one Jew, Robert Wells, originally named Levinson, and sung by another Jew, Mel Torme. Silver Bells was written by a Jew and sung by a very famous Jew. People don't really know this. Elvis Presley, whose maternal grandparents were Jewish and was always aware of his Jewish background, although he did say for some reason that it was not known in Memphis, and he was used as a Shabbos guy also, even though his mother was Jewish, he was Jewish too. Let It Snow, another Jew wrote that song. And the list goes on. All right, we shouldn't get carried away. Now to subjects about which I know very little. Fashion, though, Jewish designers have similarly shaped American culture. People like Ralph Lauren, I mentioned him first because he graduated Solanta Yeshiva, or I attended as well, graduated as Ralph Lifshitz, he even briefly went to MTA. His Bronx mate Calvin Klein, Anne Klein, Isaac Mizrahi, Kenneth Cole, Diane von Furstenberg, she married into that name. Originally Diane Halfin, her mother was a Holocaust survivor from Salonika who served in the resistance before being captured, sent to Auschwitz, and surviving. Donna Karan, Michael Kors, David Sassoon, Stuart Weitzman, and many others. Even the critic Mr. Blackwell, Richard Blackwell, was also Jewish, born Richard Seltzer. Many Jewish artists, you know, Mark Rothko, but none impressed me as much. You see where my tastes lie. As did Morris Katz, whom I met once, still in the Guinness Book of World Records, as the fastest painter. He could paint a painting in a minute or less, and a comedian as well. So he too, Morris Katz, was a Holocaust survivor from Galicia who lost most of his family to the Nazi brutality. And Katz, at least, always remained a Shomer Shabbat. I just want to mention briefly that a media, and you'll see the incredible influence that Jews have had. I think we'll discuss it separately. It's a separate topic. But just for our purpose of shaping American culture, two of the three networks were founded and run by Jews for decades. founded, meaning they gave television its first imprint in society and molded the way American society would perceive it. William Paley, a Jew, founded CBS. David Sarnoff, who was born not far from Minsk, founded NBC. Just think of those two networks. ABC was not, but it was the third of the networks. But two Jews started those networks. Neither really exercised their Jewish identity that much, although Paley, who intermarried twice, at least had the comeuppance of being denied. He married two socialites. At least he had the comeuppance of being denied admission to a Long Island country club because he was Jewish. And finally, a subject about which I know even less than fashion and art, and that is literature. I generally do not read novels, so I would not have come across in my life two renowned American Jewish novelists, Saul Bellow and Philip Roth. So Bellow was a Canadian who moved to Chicago as a child, and he spent much of his life there. Roth is from Newark. The novels of both, which would become American classics, were permeated by their Jewish identities. Now, Bellow's mother was actually very religious. She died young, but he rebelled. As far as I know, he didn't possess the anger and contempt for Judaism that Philip Roth did. Roth's depictions of Jews were often vulgar. And unfortunately, because of the popularity of his books, he left on the American public a lingering impression of dysfunctional, promiscuous Jews. To Roth, this he said openly, Torah was a burden, Jewish identity worth fleeing, and God only to deny his existence. So critics called him a self-hating Jew, perhaps the original one in an American Jewish context. He won many awards, but never the Nobel Prize, which grated on him. He's dead now, so he can't win. It especially grated because Saul Bellow did win the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1976. So Bellow did not want to be known as a Jewish writer, even as many of his characters were Jewish, and he did become more conservative politically as he grew older, and that also antagonized the literary class. While Roth intermarried once, Bellow was married five times, but mostly to Jews, and he had a very volatile personality. But in addition to his novels, he wrote a memoir after a visit to Israel entitled To Jerusalem and Back, in which he discussed Israel at length in ways that will often resonate to our ears. He wasn't talking about Oslo, he could have been, when he wrote, a great deal of intelligence can be invested in ignorance when the need for illusion is deep. Or, he wrote in the book, while Israel fought for life, debaters weighed her sins, and especially the problem of the Palestinians. In this disorderly century, refugees have fled from many countries. In India, in Africa, in Europe, millions of human beings have been put to flight, transported, enslaved, stampeded over the borders, left to starve. But only the case of the Palestinians is held permanently open. And of course, as you can imagine, the literary class held this against him. Or he said, it is so easy for outsiders to say that there are two sides to the question. What a terrible expression I'm beginning to detest. Among the most popular writers who presented Judaism positively are the Kellermans, Faye and Jonathan, and of course Chaim Potok. But Michael Chabon, or Chabin, is another Jew with an intense hatred for Judaism and Israel, and he still writes, and there are plenty of others. If literature is a window into an unknown world, for most Jewish writers, we'd be better off if their windows were shuttered and then curtained off. Rav Kook wrote, in terms of literature, open only those otzarot, those storehouses, hamivasmim heimat avir amitziyot, that perfume, beautify the air of reality, but that has not been our destiny. Imagine, what if these writers wrote without angst, or bias, or dysfunction, or ignorance? Perhaps then they couldn't write. But one wishes for all these talented people to have used their talents, as Rav Kook wrote, to enunciate holy themes, to make people better and not more troubled, to popularize heroes, not anti-heroes. Perhaps American society would be better as well. In summary, there's much more to say about American Jews and American culture, but the picture is clear. American culture is unthinkable without the Jewish contribution to it, and in some cases, its dominance, our dominance of it. But for the most part, it illustrates a lost opportunity to be an Or LaGoyim, even though in some cases, it certainly is evidence of it. I thank you all very much. Next time, we will discuss American Jews and business. Thank you all. Have a good night.